Tape 24, side 1. House Labor Committee, June 1st.
The committee will come to order. The clerk will note those present. All others are excused. As most of you know, there's an agenda tonight for Senate Bills 1048 and 1050. Through an error in my office, but Mr. Zeller, who signed up to speak previously on other workman's comp bills, thought that the hearing was on 1050 was tonight. I mean, excuse me, was this morning. And he appeared and drove all the way in, and he cannot be here this evening. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to open up the hearing on 1050 to have Mr. Zeller given the opportunity to come up and give his testimony, and then I will have that put into the record for tonight's hearing. Mr. Zeller. I'm Nelson Zeller of Albany. I'm here in representing myself and general public. I came down due to an error in a phone call that was made to me, and I'm sorry to say that it has to happen this way, but that's the way it is. I spoke before in regards to cutting the cost and cutting the workman's comp coverage in regards to the fact that if you cut your accidents down, I think you would come a heck of a lot farther. But also there's another little instance that bears a great deal of scrutiny, and that is the fact that we have private insurers in the field of the workman's compensation, and there's nothing that says that they cannot take any account that they want as long as it's a profitable account. And when it becomes a costly item to them, that they can cancel the people out. And this is one of the big things that has been bothering me throughout the years. Management in the past fought for the three-way comp bill, and they got it. Now they can't live with it. And who is to suffer other than the workman, as far as I can see? But cutting out the third step, or the circuit court step in the procedure, making it going to the appeals, court of appeals. And that is basically all I have to offer in regards to the 1050, other than I do not feel that it is in any way a help to the injured workman. Now, could I speak on 1048, or do you have something?
You go right ahead.
Well, in regards to 1048, as I can see and foresee that a permanent injured workman will not have any incentive, or it will cut the incentive. Maybe I should say it that way. It'll cut the incentive for him to become a individual who may become self-sustaining, or at least more than living on just the disability. And if you've ever had to do it, mister, it's a hell of a small amount of money to try to live on. I did for 5 months one time, and it's pretty meager. But when you take the incentive away from a man, if he's going to work and try to develop something out of what abilities he has, and then cut him back when he becomes up in the class of money, I would say that you practically cut his all idea of him trying to better himself.
Mr. Zeller, part of the bill that I think you're most concerned with is that Section 6, that is 65, it had a gradual phase out of the...
Yeah, this is the one that I am.
So, that bill had an initial hearing last week, and I think it's fair to say that all of the parties, both labor and industry, have agreed that particular section will come out of the bill. I think that labor especially was concerned about the situation that you're talking about, and I think that what happened, that when everyone reviewed it, they found out that there was probably little, if any, cost savings to anyone to have that provision, and I believe that that particular section of the bill will be deleted, Section 6.
Well, I certainly hope so, because as far as I can see, it's doing nothing except causing the fellows to sit back on his haunches and say, no, if I make anything, they're going to cut my throat, so why should I attempt to?
Even the employees recognize the problems with that section.
I hope so. I
hope that will be coming out.
Good.
So the bill, basically, the offset that will be in the law will be the permanent total and the Social Security disability offset, just those two.
Well, when you get down to the brass tacks in that manner, I would say this too, in regards to the offset from the Social Security. You might class the disability that a man incurs throughout his lifetime and becomes a permanent disabled man or injured, and you might say that is a fee that's paid out of his lifetime and to a fund or insurance policy. And then when, as I like to relate it, is the buying of an insurance policy, and then when you become 65, you start whittling it off, because it goes to the Social Security, and it places the Social Security and the federal government in the, as I see it, in the manner of picking up the tab for the workman's comp. I may be wrong, but that's the way I look at it.
So I want you to know that you and I philosophically on that issue agree completely. I think that
there's something wrong with both of us, then.
I know. I don't think that I'm going to be able to change what's going to happen, but I happen to agree personally with you on that issue.
Any other questions anybody wish? My views?
Thank you very much, Mr. Dillard. 1050 in both these bills will be set for another hearing after tonight. And
good.
This time, I'll make sure that the staff gets the correct time for you. But I will make sure that your comments now are being put on the record for tonight's hearing.
Well, I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak, because I did get up a little early.
I apologize to you for that. That was our fault.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for the love of you for the
building. Thank you, sir. The hearing on 1050 and 1048 is closed. That the bills will be heard this evening. I'll open the hearing at this particular time. The House to Senate Bill 301. The reason I'm going to hold up on 423, if I could, is Senator Attia wants to testify. Oh, they called earlier this morning.
Oh,
did you? She doesn't answer?
She doesn't answer.
Okay. Mr. Roy Green?
We're on 301.
Yes, we're going to be on 301.
Chairman, members of the city, my name is Roy Green, and I'm here jointly representing employee benefit group and AOI. We are proponents of Senate Bill 301, and perhaps so that you understand exactly what this bill does, I'd like to give you an example of what is now happening. Let's consider that this is a restaurant, and I, as the owner of the restaurant, decide to pivot. And I hire a painting contractor who brings in three or four painters, and they're up on ladders painting the roof or the ceiling, and one of them knocks a can of paint to the floor. And because he's in a hurry, and he's got another can of paint right there, he just keeps on painting. And the paint gets all over the floor, and one of my employees comes along and slips in that paint, and hurts herself. She then has the right under the third party provisions of the law to sue the painting contractor whose employee was the proximal cause of her slipping, that is, the paint on the floor. And so she sues under the third party benefits of the law and recovers something, and part of that recovery she's able to keep, and part of it goes to offset the cost of the claim. However, the painting contractor suddenly looks at his whole card and says, "Now, wait a minute, under the Oregon Safe Employment Act, you, as the owner of this building, are required to maintain good housekeeping. And admittedly, my employee did not come down and off the ladder and clean up the paint, but neither did your employees clean the paint up. And therefore, you are at least contributorily negligent." And so the painting contractor comes back and then sees me as the employer of this injured worker. Now, I have already provided workman's compensation coverage for this worker. And supposing that is the sole and exclusive remedy as far as I am concerned. However, on this so-called action over, then I not only am paying for the workman's compensation, but I'm also paying for at least part of the cost of this third-party recovery that was made. So I have actually not an exclusive remedy, but only partially exclusive remedy. This was for many years a part of the exclusive remedy was for many years a part of the law, but we've had two or three court cases in which this has been violated. And the amendments to 018 are in here to eliminate that violation of the exclusive remedy.
Well, what was the House bill?
Carl Frederick, Associated Oregon Industries. The House bill was 2202, which was introduced at the request of the Oregon State Bar. These people passed that out of committee.
If I could explain to the committee the problem we had. 2202,
yes. Okay. It had a subsequent referral to the judiciary.
It'll be in your folder.
Okay, it's in the folder. What happened is we had 2202 in the committee at the very beginning of the session. There was a bill that was introduced, as Carl said, by the Bar Association. That bill and this bill, except for, if you look at Senate Bill 301, the B and C, lines 14 to 19, are not in 2202. And what happened is that the bar came in and they said that they thought it was a good idea. The bill 2202 had a subsequent referral to judiciary. That at the same time, there was an identical bill dropped in the Senate. But after we sent 2202 to the Judiciary Committee, a number of the larger employers in the state became aware of the bill and became concerned about the so-called indemnity agreement.
Only the utilities, I might say.
Utilities.
And the railroads.
And which seems to be a practice in their industry that they have. And they thought that the way the bill was originally written, 2202, that in fact it would change and act, it would be a change to the detriment if they did not get subsections B and C, which appear in 301, into the law. Chairman Myers of the Judiciary Committee and I talked about it, and we decided that since I had the Senate bill, and it already come from the Senate, that I would handle the matter in the House Labor Committee, and he would table 2202 in the Judiciary Committee. That bill has been tabled, and what you see now are further amendments to 2202 to take care of the particular situation of the railroads and the utilities. So that's the status of why we've got this bill back again.
One thing I might point out is that Senate Bill 301 was introduced at the request of the Committee on Trade and Economic Development. There was no opposition from either the plaintiff's bar or the defense bar. In fact, it's kind of rare to see them together on an issue. Something must be wrong.
You know, Mr. O'Leary was the one that
came. Yes, Mr. O'Leary, strong advocate for the Trial Lawyers Association.
Mr. Chairman, I see the conflict report for 2202 is another Senate bill, 309, that commands the same statute.
Not in this committee, to my knowledge.
One other point, Mr. Chairman. The largest insurance carrier in the state perhaps might be able to give you some cost impact. They've had considerable experience over the years on this particular issue.
That's not true.
Well, no, I was referring to the State Action Insurance Fund, the largest mutual insurance company.
I didn't really know that you were including both the public and the private insurance
companies. As a matter of fact, I've discussed this prior to the investment bill with the counsel for the State Action Insurance Fund. Acutely aware of the problem, and I think they have some cost impact information to give you if you have to ask them.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I just want to make sure that I got this clearly embedded in my mind. But this would, all this bill does is just eliminate the ability of the third party employer to recover from the real employer.
That's correct.
It does not eliminate the ability of the workman to go after the
third party. No, sir,
does not. You don't have any objection to that?
No, whatsoever. I think they have objections.
Well, if you want to get down to solving the product liability problem, you can make workman's comp the exclusive remedy and not permit a third party action. I think that'd be an excellent idea.
I think I'd get some objections
from the chairperson.
I have a question on this. Now, if the third party is sued, it is not under workman's comp.
That's correct.
It is under another, it's another form of liability. Now, tell me about the problems with that kind of liability coverage for an employer.
Well, that's under the general, under the public liability or general liability area. It occurs actually most of the time, I believe, as a result of automotive accidents, where someone is injured in an automotive accident, and as a result, they bring action against the third party. And if the third party is found to be negligent and liable, then under a statutorily determined distribution of benefits, the benefits are the attorney's fees are taken out.
Always the attorney's fees.
Yeah, they're always out first. And then the worker gets 25% of the remainder, and then the remainder of that goes back to the carrier who insured the employer of the worker, and then if there's any extra, that goes back to the worker also.
You mean the insurer who provided the workman's compensation?
The workman's compensation coverage, correct.
Okay, so now in the illustration that you used, the painter dropping the bucket of paint, another workman being injured, if that your employee is injured as a result of the negligence of that painting the contractor, they're covered under your workman's compensation. But now, what kind of liability coverage does the painter have to have, painting contractor have to have to protect himself?
Just public liability.
Just regular public liability.
Yes.
No.
This bill,
we debated that last session, I do believe. Mm-hmm.
This bill merely returns the state of the law to what it was prior to September 1st, 1975.
Not completely, does it?
No.
Because up to that time, they could not sue the third party.
Yeah, well, it had never been tested, I guess, to the extent it had in this particular case.
Carl, you know.
But we thought the law was, I guess.
You know, you've got. Well, I think confused because you've got two different ideas. You're talking about indemnification, and they're talking, the other people here are talking about joint supervision and control in a third-party lawsuit, and that's what they want to try and separate. And could you explain that this bill does nothing to what we did last session in Senate Bill 181, and you're talking of a different type of a situation?
Yeah, this has nothing to do with joint supervision and control, but prior to last session, as the chairperson indicated, if there was a commingling of employees, even if there was more than one employer involved, then of course you could not bring the lawsuit against the third party in that case. It has nothing to do with that aspect of the law. But perhaps in the situation that Roy gave, you could not bring the third party action if there was a commingling of employees because of the joint supervision and control defense. But we're not touching that. Love to, but we're not.
You know, Roy, the attorney thing, you know, that you talked about, I understand the attorneys have copied that from insurance agents and the way they determine the cases.
Right off the top.
That's very right. Actionable, Roy.
Thank you so much. Carl, can I ask you a question? Are B and C the amendments that the utilities propose?
Yes.
In the Senate?
Yes.
What
was the concern of the utilities? You'll have to ask the utilities. Apparently they had a number of sidetrack agreements and special agreements regarding right-of-ways and this type of thing, a unique situation that other employers did not experience in everyday business activities. As a consequence, they were very dependent on these particular types of things. They want an exemption. They were able to say they didn't want to kill a bill, so I said yes.
No, okay, you protested here. You didn't sign up. Why don't we get him up here? Because I was looking for Ray or somebody.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Mr. Clay Lehman Miller, Oregon Railroad Association. So it's tradition, which I'm sure Greg, Representative Cyrus, familiar with, in connection with our common carrier, I'm speaking for railroad, service to local industries where we have sidetracks and spurs on their property. We have written agreements with them in connection with liability which may be incurred in operating on their property through no fault of the railroad, so that if somebody is a railroad employee or another person in the operation of the railroad inserting such a plant through some circumstance that is not our fault, then if the injured person sues the railroad or acts the railroad by the written agreement with the company can bring action against the company for whatever damage the court would decide is reimbursable to the railroad. Do I make myself clear? In other words, it's a written agreement. It's not, and it has to do with the provision of the commentary. We have to get service to the plants, and so this is a protection that's been traditionally of hundreds of them. Another example would be a case where I'm not an attorney, so I'm allowed my water, but we've had bills that several, you must know, through the years that touch on this area as far as railroads are concerned, where we operate with these indemnity agreements. Sometimes it has to do with a private crossing where the railroad crosses into a plant, and again, there's a written agreement as to the liability restrictions on.
Is that found in chapter 757 and 760, or?
I can find out for you.
No, the reason is I noticed the bill says that which is subject to regulation pursuant to or 757 and 760.
The one paragraph in the bill that's specifically void is the one that really disturbs our practice, and the same paragraph, the voiding paragraph, appears in both bills in exactly the same language, and that was our concern.
If I read B and C together, it says that this section, subsection, shall not apply to claims for indemnity or contribution asserted by a corporation, individual, or association of individuals, and a qualification which is subject to regulations pursuant to ORS Chapter 767, 760, that's PUC.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so then you're basically talking about all those corporations, individuals, or associations of individuals that are regulated by the PUC.
Exactly. There was some suggestion, I hope do not write language for amendments, but it simply states those companies that are under PUC regulation are exempt, but that didn't seem to suit people, so they did write in utilities and railroads in the amendment. But that is my understanding of the restriction or the exemption applies to those who have, you know, a common carrier obligation. In other words, we can't collect our customers. We have to serve them all. And it's because of that that the written indemnity agreement is part and parcel of the operation.
And sub C merely states that if there is a corporation, individual, or association of individuals which is not covered pursuant to the ORS Chapter 767 or 760, and they have such an agreement, that such an agreement would then be void.
That's what I understand. I don't want to be.
No,
all I know is that the language that there are the feel is a little subject to misinterpretation because it does spell out utilities and railroads, but the reason it was done that was I believe to recognize that we do have the statistical problem where we are required to provide the service and therefore have reason to enter into written legal voluntary agreements, I mean, that are made at the time the service is started and those from then on.
No, it's much broader than just railroads. I want you to know that. I
don't want to speak for some of the other utilities because they have very different vibrations. The power companies have some of these agreements in connection with their rights away with power lines and that kind of thing.
Ray, do you want to testify on this form, Bill?
I had an experience where I was injured on a train that was on a main line. It wasn't on a company spur, but it was because of a low hanging telephone wire that was down lower than it should have been, and I got hit by this wire and was injured. Nothing serious, and it wasn't permanent, so I was glad of that. Now, when I made a settlement for my time loss, nobody complained on it. The railroad claim agent said, "Well, we'll settle it, or if you want to go to the utilities. Either way, it didn't make any difference. So I went to the utilities insurance company and they promptly settled it. Now, had I settled with the railroad company, then this language in here would have protected their right to recover from the utility company. Is that correct?
I believe so, if they had an agreement with the utility.
Well, this was a situation where it wasn't an industrial spur, it was just an overhead.
Well, I'm not sure the
condition.
I presume that overhead wires, things like that, are covered. One of the examples that was used in the other hearing was a case where, and I believe there was a circumstance for switching into a plant, there was some lumber left right on the edge of the track by some of the people employed by the plant, a pile held at shelter, and as the locomotive cleared it, it hit one of the boards that swung around and injured one of the fellows on the locomotive. He, of course, was able to collect from the railroad for this injury, and the railroad in turn, under its agreement with the company, was able to recover for them because it was their employee that left the lump on the neck.
And that's what this accepting language preserves, that right, is that correct?
That
ability.
Yes, that's what we do not want, that kind of an agreement, so maybe a legal.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tom. Tom Bessnett. Tom, let me ask you a question before you start. These indemnification agreements, I'm sorry, before you start, these indemnification agreements are contractual. It isn't a common law right, is it? It's a contractual agreement by which a party agrees to indemnify. Let me say, the third party agrees to indemnify the employer if, in fact, there's an injury from the result, whatever it is. Isn't that the situation that arises? And what you have is, in the workman's comp area, what you, out of that Kaiser case, if you had the workman, or the employer going against the third party under its indemnification agreement, and it's just a group of insurance lawyers, with the third-party claimant. Actually, there's no money coming to the claimant himself. It's just all transpiring between the insurance carriers, with the lawyers getting wealthy on their time. Do I understand that correct?
Yeah. There is no additional money coming to the injured claimant.
Yeah.
My name is Tom Bessnett with Oregon Mutual Insurance Company. The plaintiff received the amount of the original award. The rest of the action is between the insurance companies and the attorneys, and we're trying to cut out one of those actions by the support of this bill. Now, I come in from a little different angle.
What action is that?
The action, the indemnification or the contribution action. That's just between two insurance companies as a rule, unless one employer might not have insurance for some reason. And then there are two more attorneys employed. And so we're actually trying to cut out that one action, which the court gave right to, not the legislature, in their decision. Now, I come in from this from the standpoint that I represent a liability insurance carrier only. In other words, we write the comprehensive general liability on people. We do not write workman's compensation. On first blush, it would appear we might have some reservations about this type of legislation being adverse to our policyholders' interest. But in equity and in fairness to everybody, we feel that we should support this type of legislation instead of opposing. So we add our support to it.
If I remember correctly, this is the identical situation that existed with the, what was that, Harbor and Longstone prior to 72, and then Congress passed a law specifically like this to exempt those type of lawsuits.
You'll have
and
to.
The Oregon Supreme Court picked it up here and went 74, 75 and put it into that case. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bill, do you want to say anything? Mr. Frederick volunteered the services of the community.
I'm Chuck Gill, manager of State Act Insurance Company, the largest company in the state of Oregon. This is Keith Maloney, counsel. We have certainly endorsed the bill, and just as a point of interest, since the case came down in 75, we've had 17 cases, maybe more right now, that involve the action over in amounts of ranging from $54,000 to $2.3 million of actions brought. A substantial amount of money, and these cases can be very, very expensive. Not only that, they're very difficult to handle from a legal standpoint. They create an awful lot of problems for the carriers and for the employers if by any chance he does not have the type of coverage to take care of this kind of indemnity. There is another factor in it that Mr. Maloney, I think, might point out to the committee. He's been involved in this this type of legal work for many years, and probably could clear up a couple of things.
Go right ahead.
Yes, at one point you were suggesting that these were all written agreements. There's two kinds of indemnity cases, express and implied. USF&G versus Kaiser case was there was no written agreement at all. It was based on implied warranty that the employer would use a piece of machinery in the proper manner. And so you do have the two kinds of indemnity agreements, the ones where there is a written hold harmless agreement, like the railroads and the utilities, and then you have the additional liability, which is based on a breach of an implied warranty that you will do this work or use this machine in a proper manner. So this bill voids both the express and the implied warranties, with the exception of the utilities, and it gives them both.
That phrase that appears on line 17 and 18, where it says all agreements are warranted, picks up everything, you think.
Right.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anyone have a motion on this bill?
Sure, with any kind of motion,
sir. I'm going to move the floor. Representative Starr moves that the Central Appeal 1 be sent to the floor with a detailed recommendation. Is there any further discussion?
Yes.
Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Otto?
Aye.
Representative Riebel?
Aye.
Representative Rogers?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Wilhelm?
Aye.
Chairperson Kulongowski?
Aye. Senator 301 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll carry the bill. Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on that? Senator 422. The chair is going to appoint a subcommittee of one of Representative Otto to meet with all interested parties on this to try to work out subparagraph B. Lisa, really, I think that at this particular time, the only one who signed up, and I would be prepared to do is to have you wait and go to the meeting and represent the bottle causer. It's the chair's feeling about the bill that listening to the testimony that other than what Representative Rogers pointed out on page 3, subsection 1, as far as the length of the sentence, and legislative council is working on that to rephrase that so that it is much more understandable. But it appears that there is not much dispute as to the purposes and intent of the changes in the law on page 3 and law 654.082. It seems that the controversy in the bill is centered around sub D on page 2. It's my feeling, and this is the chair, I know it represents a lot of work on it, but that is an issue which I really don't know if we're going to be able to compromise, because we are going to allow an individual a private cause of action in that situation, or you're not. And I think you can move the language around all you want, and you can attempt to draft it so it's very restrictive, but still I think you have to answer the threshold question of whether we're going to further expand the concept, or I should say that we're going to further move into the area of the exclusive remedy of workers' compensation. And I would ask the representative Otto, when he works with the subcommittee, if he would look at the possibility instead of, and maybe I'm saying this to you, so you can tell Dick, because I'm going to have lunch with him and talk to him, of whether in fact that in that situation, maybe the better thing to do is to look at the penalty provisions under the safety OSHA. In other words, if you want to go and you think that is that important of an issue that the legislature wants to look at, I think that you can look at fines that would be rather considerable. And I'm talking about a fine of maybe $5,000 to $10,000 to the employer. Is that as an alternative to putting sub B into the law, which is moving away from the exclusive remedy of workers' compensation? And I thought about this for some time, and even though I personally feel that it's a very serious situation, I am concerned that if we keep, as we did last session with the red tag in this particular division, that we're going to eventually emasculate the exclusive remedy concept of workers' compensation. So I would rather look at it as a safety problem rather than as a workers' compensation type situation. Now, if that is any suggestion. Okay. Representative Otto will set the time and the hearing for that when he so desires. I'm going to close the hearing on 422. The next two bills up, the first one is House Bill 2656. Now, I would like, well, I'm going to bring up, since both people have signed up for both bills, it's rather interesting. Mr. Randall and Mr. Lawrence, Mr. Randall represents the Oregon AFL-CIO, Mr. Lawrence represents the Gibbons Company, which represents a number of employers in this area of unemployment compensation. It's interesting that they're the only two people that signed up on the bill, but they're just opposite. On the maximum benefits increase, Mr. Randall is for that, Mr. Lawrence is against it, and on the bill to restrict voluntary quit to compensation, Mr. Randall is against it, Mr. Lawrence is for it. Now, what I would like to do with both of these bills is for the committee to look at them as somewhat of a quid pro quo. Now, maybe the parties will not, but maybe that the committee could understand and look at it in the sense that if there's going to be an increase in benefits, then a voluntary quit bill is going to come out. And I, one of the things I do not have, and it's my fault, is that when I started working on it, I have not got a cost estimate or an anticipated expenditure saving to the employers if the voluntary quit bill passes. I don't know how much money that the employees would save under that, and what I guess I'm getting at, Ross, is whether the fact that the money, the people who would be disqualified under the voluntary quit bill, that the benefits they would receive will offset any benefit increase that would transpire because of an increase in the maximum benefits to 60%. Have you got that figure?
Well,
Why don't I do this? If the committee would look at 2656 and 2398 together, and here, if you would look at 2398, this is the maximum benefit bill, and there is a particular provision amendment in your bill book, if you will look at it. There's a mock-up version of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the very first one where it says proposed amendments to House Bill 2398, and these were the amendments that were proposed by the Oregon State AFL-CIO. And what the amendments do is they move to 60% maximum benefit, but they do it in a two-year increment. If you look over on page 3 of the mock-up version on line 11, you'll note that sub B starts out 57.5% of the state average weekly wage from the preceding calendar year, and then there's a new insert that says 60% of the state average, it's a C, it says 60% of the state average weekly wage covered for the preceding calendar year effective. So it's got it in two-year increments.
Yeah.
Do you have that? It's in the front of the bill book of 2398.
Oh.
I haven't been able to locate the mock up. Oh, here it is. Okay. All right.
I guess the one that has proposed amendments, they're the ones that have proposed amendments. Now, also on that page, and I'm going to ask Libby if I'm correct, sub C has been deleted. That's the little sub C. If I'm not mistaken, on page 3 of 2398, it was.
Mm.
I don't know if it's ever been actually deleted or not. Libby, why don't you come on up here?
Okay.
Now, if you want to see the amendments that were adopted on 318, in the same sequence as 2398, if you look at the bill itself, the committee has marked on that bill those amendments that have been deleted. So if you look at adopted. Got it.
Okay.
Now, Libby, the first question I've got to ask you, I want to ask you, is that have we got cost figures in the book now from you on the amended version of 2398 as far as the year and a half and year and a half? I mean, two and a half and two and a half increments.
I have Libby Leonard, Supervisor of Benefits Employment Division. I think possibly Ross would want to speak to this. We have some figures. Whether or not they've been presented to the committee or not, I am not aware.
Ross, why don't you go once again to the figures you have on 2398 and let us know if, in fact, they're broken down into the two and a half and two and a half increments.
Yes, they are.
Okay, go ahead.
I don't know whether this is presented to the committee or not, but we have a sheet that, I don't know how many copies of it you have. Anyway, we have a breakdown on the 20%, the 60%, we have a breakdown on the 25, and 57.5, and 25 to 60%, and that figure there shows the 77-79 biennium, an estimate of $26,420,000.
Okay, now how much is that above what would currently be paid out under the 55?
That's the additional cost in plus.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I am law.
Okay.
26,420,000 $26,420,000.
And that's the step?
That's stepping it up 2.5% each step.
Okay, now what I want to know, Ross, is how much of that is in the 2.5 increase on the maximum, and how much of it is the increase on the 15 to 25%?
Well, I don't have that breakout. I think it's possible to get it because they have to go through that in order to come up with it. So I could probably get one. But you have to know that the amount of money involved in changing the lower minimum is not the major part. That's a small part of it.
Okay.
I can't give you the percentage, but I know that it wouldn't be more than 10 to 15% of it at the most.
Does everyone have the sheet for the April 19, 1977?
They
only had a copy of that. Well, that's what we're looking at. We're going to go down here to 20.
Mr. Chairman, on that thing, it doesn't indicate a 26 million
out of list. No, that's what I'm going to try and get to, because I think he's going to be doing that now.
Mr. Chairman, there is a more later dated one than 2 minutes.
Why don't we just wait a minute or two and we'll check each other out, too.
We want to come to all of the questions and we'll tell you all of the questions.
$7 million. Oh, I see. Okay.
Of the 26, $7 million is ascribable to
25%. If you were to lower that to 20%, the cost would be $4.8 million.
Okay. Okay. So actually, if I am, let me look at this. We're looking at. Okay. Okay. So the total cost of that package then is $26,420,025.
That's right.
For the biennium, if we go to 20 and 57 and a half, it's $19 million. And then
for all the difference between 4.87 is the
only. Oh, I'm a total cost.
Total cost, you deduct the. Well, if you went to 20%, what's the difference?
That would be roughly $21.2 million. In other words, for the maximum and the minimum.
It's not that much. If you're doing that.
No.
If it's between 4.87.
I'm 2.2.
Bill, I'm saying it wrong. Bill,
I need to slow things down here, but let's go back to the original starting point. We're looking at this start date is May 4th,
right.
77, and down at C.
Yeah.
And there's $26,420,000 for 77, 79.
That's
right. Okay. And of that, $4.8 million.
No, seven million of that.
No, let me take it in steps.
Right.
$4.8 million of that is in going to 20%, and then an additional $2.2 million is taking it on up to 25%.
No,
I've got a no.
Right. Out. This is one of the benefits of being the senior umpire.
Where's the 19.2 come
from? I think the senior umpire did that one day.
Am I correct? Is that stage now?
All right.
Okay.
You are correct or you're not correct?
Let him say it again if it could miss it.
Go ahead. Okay. I'll
reset it. We're starting out on C with 26.42 million, and of that, if we instead of 25%, it was 20%, it would be 4.8 that of this takes it to 20%. Then taking it on up to 25% adds another 2.2 for a total of $7 million. So if we left it at 15% on the bottom, we're really talking about $19,420,000. Okay. Now that takes care of 77-79. Now if we move on over to 79-81, you have the same sort of figures for us?
I don't have the breakout of the minimum maximum for the 81.
Okay, because now we've jumped up $4 million, but that's because of now we're in a solid 60%. Can we assume at that time that of that $30 million, that $7 million of it, or roughly $7 million of it, is due to increasing from 15% to 25%.
Well, it'd be a little more than that. It'd be a little more than that because your percentage is going to raise the amount of money.
Okay, because it's for the full 2 years instead of just part of the 2 years. So actually, it's $7 million plus.
That's correct.
And you don't know quite how much the plus is.
No.
Okay. All right. Now, I've got another question. Without to get away from the cost on this, and maybe the rest of the committee doesn't want to leave the cost up, but I would want to know, we were given figures on what the minimum benefit would be at 15%, minimum benefit at 20%. Now, do you have the figures on the minimum benefit at 25%?
I believe they're shown there. That's in the Rogers in the parentheses.
Oh, okay. That's what that.
Him on the right hand side.
That's what that $58 represents.
The 51 and the 65.
Yeah, 58 and 63.
Right.
Okay. But now this minimum benefit is based. The person could draw no less than that minimum benefit.
Right.
Is it conceivable that at a $58 a week minimum benefit level, which the person would be getting more than their average wage had been for the qualification period?
Yes, this would be possible because it depends on how their earnings were. In other words, if you'd assume that person only made $700 or $1,000, depending on whether or not you like what they're going to do with that. In 18 weeks, then they'd be working maybe 1 or 2 days a week. Ordinarily, they got a part-time job, and they lost it. This $58 or $51 or whatever it's going to be could very much easily be more than they were getting before.
Okay, now, I also had previously, if I'm correct, that if we go to 20%, that will, under current laws, as far as you know, we will then be paying the highest minimum of any of the 50 states?
Yes, we would.
At 20%?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
go right ahead.
At what point do we take care of the problem of the possibility of a person being able to draw more on benefits than their average wage was? At what percentage would we cut that problem off, or would we? Does that exist today?
I think it could.
It could,
depending on how the person works.
Yeah.
What kind of work do they have? When you get to those minimums you're talking about, you see, they've got to be over $700 if they make $2.30 and work full time. They're going to make a lot more than $700. So, when you get down to that minimum, now there are too many of those, let's be honest.
Okay.
There are a lot of people that are drawing at that very rate. But you ask, is it possible? And yes, it is.
Are we going to compound the problem if we.
So there's going to be more of it if you do this.
There may not be many of them, but they sure add up to some bucks in a hurry.
Do we, well, never mind. Most of the people at the minimum amount usually exhaust their claim before they find another job. Well, at 15%, where do we stand in relationship to the rest of the country?
I think we're third highest now at 15.
There's a chart in the book here from the Quickie Research Company. I have to assume that that's relatively accurate. Or maybe it's not in your book. No, this is something that I had got, some data that I had got.
But,
well,
Ross, let me ask you this. How many states are on the percentage and how many are on the fixed dollar?
I think Libby has that, I think.
Well, I don't have it summarized. I have the data here from which I could gather it.
Okay, Libby, I guess, you know, when you say the third highest, is that, I didn't understand that.
In dollars.
In dollars. In dollars. That's in dollars?
In dollars.
In other words, our max, our minimum benefit right now is $28.
That's right.
And that is the third highest in the country.
Yeah.
For 28.
I can give you the exact, Indiana pays $35 as a minimum weekly benefit amount. California pays $30 and Oregon pays $28.
Where's the range? Where would be the mean?
I'd say between $11 and $20. I've broken them out in $5 increments.
Here's 22 states are listed on this particular chart, and the ranges look like $10 is the lowest. They range up. There are a lot of them around 15 and 16. There's some that are variable.
Hawaii pays $5 a week.
Hawaii's not on this one, so. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. It is on this one, and I overlooked that. That was below. I missed it. Okay.
You've got 9 states that pay between $6 and $10 a week.
Mm-hmm.
You've got 20 states that pay between $11 and $15. Then 14 states played between 16 and 20. Then over $20, you only have 8 states that pay over $20. Well, where are we in maximum now?
Where are we compared to other states? About the middle of the range.
There's 19 states that pay more at the maximum than we do. At 50% will be good.
So you don't know yet until you find out what other legislatures have done this.
That's another issue. Yeah, there's a lot of movement going on.
Yeah.
If
everybody else stayed the same, there would be 10 states that would pay more than we did if we went 60% July 4th.
So you can assume that there will be more of that because we would say that. And this is strictly on the benefit program. Now, this doesn't include any dependents allowance or...
I was going to get to that. Oregon doesn't have that concept.
Only the two states that do.
No, is that all?
That's two states?
Yeah.
It creates different problems. That's why states have to die.
No, but I mean, it is an additional benefit to
some
people.
In some states, yeah. Mm-hmm. Pennsylvania, principally.
Okay, so we've got a total, if we go to 2057 and a half this next year, we've got, what is the figure again, 21?
If you go to
2057 and a half this year.
The amount of the cost?
Yes.
19 million? That's under
$1 billion,
isn't it?
Well, I looked at that.
It's at $19 million.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But the dates may be off here, so our figures may be off. When do you start?
Yeah,
that would make a difference.
Okay. Now, if I could, because we're talking about both bills, I want to talk about the voluntary quit bill. As far as if the bill were passed, so that maybe that the bill will pass the way it's written, except that we've got that first sentence of the proposed amendment rather than all the other parts. You have an estimate of how much money that will save.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you look, now we're at it, if you look at House Bill 2656, in the book,
Mr. Kenny Glass, one more question on this before we go to 2056. Can you project what effect that this will have on the fund as far as the length of time that the fund adequacy percentage ratio would be such that employees are going to be at the maximum tax rate?
Yeah, that's a second payment of what they just made for.
I don't have that. And Ross, this doesn't show 25% minimum. It just goes to 20, 57, and 60. So I don't know what 25 would delay it a little longer.
Do you have one? Right? No. Well, wait. No, I think that we do.
I think you've got this in.
That looks familiar. That looks familiar.
Yeah, tell him you have a lot of that in the book.
That looks a little
weird. The increase will.
Oh, I don't have it in here anyway.
That wasn't there.
Okay.
except for the leading to a company or joint account. Yes, I would. If you just had the first sentence and none of the rest of it, we wouldn't change anything we're doing now.
Okay. Now,
first sentence.
Okay, so I delete that particular sentence. The only different thing is that the bill is passed which says that a person who voluntarily quits their appeal, which says the individual voluntarily left work without good cause, that if he was found to have left work without good cause, that he could not draw unemployment benefits unless he worked for 4 weeks after that. Now, under that situation, you have a cost savings on that idea.
Now, are you saying that if he was discharged for misconduct?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. Well, then I would. And we're leaving out this accompany spouse thing.
Yeah.
Right now,
I want you to apply the law like you always interpret it right now. The only difference is under the present law that if you wait 8 weeks, you can draw.
Right.
But
okay.
The way this bill passed is that he wouldn't be able to do that until he worked for 4 weeks.
$37 million.
That this cost fiscal impact.
He would have a decrease in benefits paid of $37 million. The way you just described it.
Well, that's like the original bill then.
The original bill is 6 weeks and this is four.
Okay, let's see. That would be a difference.
Right, but now, now the law is 8 weeks and or 2 weeks, right?
Or four.
Four. Either it's 4 weeks or you sign up for 8 weeks.
That's what it is now.
Or combination.
All right, now, the story I heard when we took our trip around the state, you could quit, be off a couple of weeks, work a couple of weeks, and be on, and then quit, and then be on unemployment.
That's not correct. If you quit for a marital domestic reason, to accompany your spouse or something like that, all you have to do is have 1 week's work.
Okay.
To requalify.
Everybody else 4 weeks, but if you must quit under the present law, 1 week is worth it.
Or 8 weeks, you could sign off in 8 weeks.
The only other reason you could quit, let's say you say, I quit on a Friday, 24, voluntary quit, and go to work for. How many weeks would I have to work for another employer before I could go four?
If you quit without good cause, for some reason that wasn't marital domestic, you'd have to work 4 weeks to draw on before you could draw unemployment. Or you would have to sign up in our office 8 weeks.
Okay.
But now, listen, Mr. Chairman. Well, I'll ask you what you do. If a person quit, as in the case of Representative Otto cited, and then worked 4 weeks, and then quit, he'd be disqualified and would have to work four more.
It's his last separation from work where he had at least 4 weeks. If you come into our office and file a claim and said you just got laid off, but you only worked for your last employer 2 weeks, and it turned out that you had quit your prior job, you could still suffer a disqualification.
Right. Well, could or would.
You would if it was a quit without good cause.
And then if I went to work for another employer for 2 more weeks
then
and got laid off from that one, then I would qualify.
That's right. You have to have 4 weeks of subsequent work after any disqualifying separation.
Yeah. If you don't have a fiscal impact on this bill with these amendments.
No. Not with those amendments, no.
I do know how many disqualifications we issued under to accompany or join a spouse in calendar year 1976. And but we would not have issued those under these proposed amendments.
And under these amendments, how would the person be equipped to accompany the spouse be affected?
Well, with these amendments, the way I read them, it would be considered to be good cause, and they wouldn't be disqualified.
Maybe, if I could, Gary, that's a difficult area to understand when reading the statute. If you look at the bill, the sub 3, now what is the current status of the law in sub 3 of the proposed amendment? If an individual left work to be married, or if an individual left work to accompany his or her spouse, or companion, or joint, or companion, or joint
companion,
okay, see, the individual left work because of his premarital status or domestic duty. If you fall into A, B, or C, that is in essence not good cause.
No, we don't call it not good cause, Mr. Chairman. We say that it may have been good cause under sub 2C above, but it is disqualifying under sub 3.
Okay. Now, if in fact we adopt the amendment, let's just assume the proposed amendment, okay, we would have to delete A, B, and C under
Well, I don't know that you'd have to, but if you say that it's going to be good cause to accompany or join a spouse at a place where it's impractical to accept and transfer commute to such work in one part of the law, and then you say that it's going to be disqualifying to leave work because of your marital status, it seems to me you have a slight problem. I would have
now,
a problem.
That's why I said that if we adopt the amendment, we have to delete
okay. That
from that section.
All right.
Now, let me ask you. If you keep standing as it presently is in the statute,
yes,
and you do not adopt the amendment, except you know, the big one on the side. You do know what is the change in the law as far as how you interpret it?
You said we do not adopt the big one on the side?
Yeah, we do not adopt the big one on the side, but we do not adopt
the 8-week satisfaction.
That's right.
All right, now the figure, now you want to know about money.
Well, I want to know both. I want to know money, and I want to know what, how you're going to interpret that.
Well, I would interpret the law the way I am doing right now, which would be, good cause would be the, you're talking about whether or not personal reasons would be good cause.
That's what I'm asking.
Okay. We have areas.
I know. That's exactly the case that worries me.
And we have found that some things which are could be considered of a personal nature can be objectively related to the work, such as a person who is seriously ill and can no longer work. We figure that's objectively related to the work, and we call it good cause.
Except they cannot draw benefits.
Well, not until they're able to work.
If they could
quit and then 6 months later or 2 months or whatever.
Okay. Let me ask you one more situation in this whole exchange. If I were to keep three as it is, but delete sub B from the section so that A and C remain, but sub B is deleted.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that would do with the division's interpretation of that section as far as leaving work to accompany his or her spouse?
I think I'll defer that to the policymaker.
I don't think I understand what
if you take out the disqualification for leaving to accompany the spouse and you don't put in a positive statement that it is good cause, what would we do with it?
That's right. That's exactly right.
Well, we got a problem with the Ayers case. I think either way,
And I think if it's the legislature's wish that the error case is wrong, in other words, that that's taking too strict an interpretation, which is, I don't know how many of you read that, but that was Dave Kinney's opinion, that it had to be work-related. And we've not been interpreting quite that strictly. You could take a very strict interpretation of that if you wanted to, and it could be a lot tougher than what it is. But if you really want to go away from that strict interpretation, the agency needs that first sentence from your side, the authorized representative designated by the administrator may consider employment-related as well as non-employment-related reasons in determining whether an individual left work without good cause. You need that sentence if it's into the legislature to go away from that.
Okay, now,
we haven't been interpreting those very strictly, but it's still there, and it can go up. Somebody, when we take a lenient stand on it, it very well can go on up through the field and get back to court again.
One further point on that, and one reason why we haven't been doing it as strictly as it may have been, as it may be construed, is that in another part of our law, in 657471, we can relieve an employer's account if a person voluntarily quits with good cause not attributable to the employer. And so we have been saying the legislature must have assumed that there would be some reasons which weren't attributable to the employer, and therefore we're finding some.
Well, let me just tell you, the problems I have when with the proposed amendment on the side, and to give you an idea, if you just take the first sentence, I've looked at that, and said it is extreme broad grant of power with no standard to the administrative agency. And I worry about that. I do not believe that that's good legislation to do that, just as a policy matter. Secondly, if I don't enumerate the specific situations that I'm talking about, and I word it in a sense that it's for reasonable cause or for, you know, the standard, the reasonable management, what I'm going to do then is defer to the court to decide what is the reasonable man standard. And I don't want the court to do that. So what I'm looking at is some way to get around the earlier case and still be able to have a standard for you to apply that isn't so broad that we're going to pick up every non-job-related reason for leaving and put it into the statute. Now, I would really believe that if I just adopted the first sentence and nothing else, the employers would really have a concern about what you were going to do. Now, I have a good trust in your judgment, Mr. Mayor, and believe me, in your division now, but I know that you're not going to be there all the time, and I could see that this would become a political football as to whoever's going to be there. How are we going to interpret that? And I could get an administrator in there that would say, "My guys, I'll tell you how I'm going to interpret that. Job related, that's it, period." And then I could get another guy in there that's going to say, "Listen, I think everybody should be on unemployment if they're not working." And then I'd say, "Every reason that guy left the job was was compensable." And I think there's got to be some other grounds in the middle of this thing that we can work this out.
I agree with you.
Go ahead.
Ed North said with the employment reason. Well, until the Arias case came along, we had been using the terminology left work without good cause as the basis for disqualification for probably some 35, 40 years. And I don't know of anything that would be any more broad or than just the terminology left work without good cause.
Work is voluntarily leaving work with good cause.
Okay. it could be something to do with the work itself, where the conditions of work were injurious to your health, safety, or morals, something like that. It could be a personal reason, such as where you would have no alternative but to leave, and there again you fall back on illness or injury.
If they're on a voluntary quit with good cause,
that's right.
All right, now how do they qualify under the existing? If they're voluntary leave in good cause,
they don't get paid.
They
don't
get
paid.
There's lots of them.
Yeah.
They don't have to requalify in any manner. It would be nice if we could have a scale. In the law, you know, if a guy gets a scam, you just don't get anything. And if you voluntarily leave, you know, without good cause, then you work 6 weeks. And then if you voluntarily leave with good cause, then you've got to work 3 weeks. And then if you get laid off, you're willing to qualify or something. Well, why can't we do something like that? Because I know the AFL-CIO is concerned about the person that's you know, they get mad and quit because he can't stand his boss anymore. I haven't got too much sympathy for him, but I don't think you ought to be treated the same as somebody that's discharged, or, you know, it's him. Or it's discharged for misconduct or something like that, you know. But the law doesn't seem to have its priorities very well established. It seems like maybe we should be a little problem. Wearing this out in some kind of a situation. How does the federal law what kind of mandate do we have on it?
No mandate.
So, in fact, if we wanted to exclude a guy that was canned for misconduct, we could do that.
That's right.
But, you know, you can do it there.
You can do it maybe with tests on this side of the law, if that's, they have them. They might comment, but there's no guideline.
That's German. On anything other than fraud or some criminal activity, you can't take away the whole claim. You can forfeit up to all of the claim except $1. In other words, nobody's ever defined how much you have to leave there. But generally, I know of no state that has taken away 100% of the claim unless there was some criminal activity that was involved in the discharge.
is having a problem
and their work relationship with their employers. Under the present law, before that situation becomes so intolerable, what happens is the employer quits. And one of the reasons they quit is I think it's because they know if they do not look for a job, that they can go on employment for a week. And if you draw too specific standards, what's going to happen is a practical matter. The employee's going to know if he can get on employment. He's going to know then the only way he can get on employment is to be fired. And so what's going to happen is the employee's going to sit there and start thinking, what do I have to do to get fired? And so that has a disastrous effect for two people. For the employer, he's got an employee that is in essence just screwing around, looking to get fired, probably disrupting the workforce, a variety of other things. But it also puts that employee in a position that he's going to have a file on his work record. He's going to have been fired from the job. So I think it's just an impossible situation. I don't think the employers are going to benefit from that situation as a practical matter. Because the employer, I really believe, will just sit back there and force the employer to fire him. And then the employee can't have to live with that on his work record. But it's that narrow situation we're trying to address in which there's a real legitimate reason for the person to quit the job. It may be a step short of being fired. It may be at the mutual convenience of both parties, the employer and the employee. But if we draw it too narrowly, I'm afraid that we're going to create a situation for both the employers and the employees that will not be good. And I might tell the committee one other thing. You know, I've been following the laws in the other states, and all the states that seem now to be going through reform in the unemployment area, and one thing that they've hit on is the disqualification completely for voluntary quits. And there are a number of states this year that have adopted this approach.
Bill. What you're saying is that you do not want a matrix like the parole board uses.
Right.
It's very hard to follow it. You've got your own that you've developed by administrative policy and precedent over a number of years. But I'm not, maybe I should be, but I'm really not uncomfortable with you having that first son in the law. That doesn't bother me as much as it seems to bother some of the other folks, because I look at the past performance, and I know that things can shift, but you're also a pretty big bureaucracy, and bureaucracy shifts slowly. Now, I've got another question.
Go ahead, Bill.
I seem to recall, and I may be wrong on this, that on page 3 of the printed bill, if we leave that just exactly the way it is, that we can have some problems. Is that correct? Don't we have to, under any circumstance, under any circumstance, eventually have to pay someone to be in compliance with the federal law?
No.
No. Okay, well, I misunderstood.
In other words, there are some states that, as a condition of the disqualification, you forfeit, or your total benefit amount is reduced by a certain number of weeks.
Yes.
And if I understood Representative Williams there, he was suggesting that maybe the whole claim be forfeited if you were discharged under certain conditions. And that is permissible only to the extent that you are discharged for some type of criminal
fraud.
If you have been involved in fraud and collecting unemployment benefits before.
Fraud, criminal,
felony. Conviction of a felony or a fraud.
No. So I'm still a little bit confused on this on page 3. because if we adopt this as it is written and someone voluntarily leaves work without good cause and doesn't re-qualify under this on lines 22-28 on page 2, he would never be eligible.
That's right, but he has the opportunity, you see.
I see. As long as he has the opportunity.
As long as he has the opportunity.
Okay. Well, that's what, okay, I missed that point.
There's several states that have, in other words, like California, I don't know how long they've had it in the law, but they have had a requirement that we must work five and earn five times a week the benefit amount, whether it be a discharge or a voluntary quit or sometimes.
Is that better than stating it in weeks, the way we do?
I think it has the same net effect.
It's the same, it means the same thing, just stating it. Right. Okay. Well, that's, you've given us over a period of a number of hearings and over quite a period of time, things that you would and would not pay benefits on. And I think that based on the present law, you would administer it quite well. Actually, I may not agree with a couple of it, but, and so that's the reason that I don't have any hang up about giving you that first sentence in these amendments and leaving it at that. And that would allow you to deal with the RFC in a way that you are already doing, except that you are subject now to a challenge.
That's right. Mr. Chairman, sticking to this voluntary quit just a moment, please, if I could. One of the things that a lot of people are concerned about in the voluntary quit is that and nobody can prove whether this is right or wrong, but a lot of people are quitting the job because they know their employment's available. And that they're not too concerned because there are a lot of second incomes and third incomes in families, and so they're not up against the wall as they would have been years ago. One of the benefits of tightening down the law somewhat is that people would take a second look, because you could have good cause if you tried to work out your problem with your boss if you had a problem. And maybe they'd take a second look and do a better job, because if they've searched out every way to stay on that job and they've done everything that anybody would prudently do to keep the job by going to a supervisor and saying, my foreman and I just don't get along. Is there some other way that you can, or some other place in the plant that I could work? If a search is made, rather than just getting up and quit because you have a problem with your supervisor or your foreman, if a real attempt is made to try to rectify the problem, we'd call that good cause for quitting. And so I think, and a lot of people don't know that could happen if they did it that way. They just get mad and they get up and they say, I'm going, and away they go.
Bill, let me, before you begin, there's a meeting in the governor's office right now, and what I'm going to do, since this is on the agenda, I'm going to, instead of adjourning the meeting this morning, I'm going to recess the meeting, and we're going to carry these two bills over to tonight's session, because I want to get this thing resolved now. You're going to love me for that, both of you, but here's what I'd like to do, but it's extremely difficult for the folks, to the committee members, to be able to read 2656 the way it's set out, because I can't understand exactly what we're deleting and what we're adding. What I would like you to do is, if you could, by tonight, just look at this bill. I want the first sentence of that amendment put into the appropriate spot, and I want the deletion from 6 to 4 weeks, and I'm still unsure what we're doing with 3 if we just give you the first sentence. Now, I guess what I would like to do as a starting point of showing you intent with the committee, and if I could, and I'll let the committee members express to them, to you, if they disagree. What we're trying to get at is that, one, that the individual who voluntarily quits his job without good cause, that before he will be able to draw unemployment benefits, that he will have to work 4 weeks at covered employment. And we're going to take away, in essence, the 8-week waiting period point. That's the heart of it. The second thing is I want to take care of the situation, as Representative Rogers said, about the earlier case, so that you can have the authority to consider certain limited exceptions to the Arias case. Now,
you said covered employment. Do you mean covered employment?
Yeah, I thought about that after I said it, and I'm is that standard with the other? Is just any employment?
We don't consider, as long as a person earns equal to or in excess of his weekly benefit amount. We don't care whether it's covered or not. Some states do say it's covered, some don't. And we never have because it's administrative.
You've never covered, you said, okay, don't put a covered employment in. And I got one other thing I want to talk to you about. If you could get an amendment that would relate, you know, one of the things that I think I found out about the employment division that bothers me somewhat is on this matter of drawing unemployment, that there's no reporting. It's an extremely difficult administrative problem for you people to determine whether a person is actively seeking, you know, and is in the job market. Now, I do not want to get into the idea that they have to come in person to draw their unemployment benefit.
They do.
They do.
They come in every other week and they
do. But they don't have to show you anything
yes,
if they've
they
done
do.
What do they have to show?
They have to show contacts they've made for each week they report for.
They
have to show the name of the employer, the person contacted, the date, and the results of the interview.
But, Mr. Chairman, you do not follow up then and contact to see if they actually made those
no.
contacts. If you have good
we have 120,000 contacts every week.
I'm not going to get into that because the employment agency within the largest agencies in the state, but if there's no suitable work for them to go look for, they don't have to give you any list.
Yes, they do.
To show that they are active.
Yeah, all it depends upon if it's a logging season and he's a logger and he's going to be off for 3 or 4 weeks, he just shows he's contacting his former employer, yes. But
if I don't need the approval system, then that was an example.
I would suggest another type of work if you're going to continue to live in Bend.
Okay, but that's what I mean. If I'm not on the summit, I don't have to go around and bring you a list of all the people that I applied for a job as a nuclear physicist.
No, but for
some other job, he would.
You'd have to pick out what else you thought was that would be suitable. Yeah.
What about a person that hires out to a hiring hall?
No, just as long as they show that they're on the out-of-work list and in good standing with the union.
Okay, Eddie, the only thing I have is that on page 3, this section 5 is being deleted. That seems to me to be much broader than what we're trying to reach. Am I right or wrong by just deleting that whole thing? Because that appears to me to be including things other than voluntary quit.
Yeah, I would mean that if you're discharged from misconduct, you have to work for a week. If you fail to apply
I want it limited only to voluntary quit. Okay?
Yeah.
No, you can argue that. I mean, it's...
You have what limited to voluntary quit?
The 4-week disqualification, the 8-week disqualification period, waiting period taken out.
You want to leave an 8-week waiting period in for somebody to get in?
Yes.
You mean laid off?
No. If you read the bill, what it is 2 and 3, that section 5 deletes an 8-week waiting period for discharge from misconduct.
Any of the things in sub 2 and 3.
That's right. That's exactly it.
There's basically three conditions under which disqualification occurs. Either you quit,
you're discharged or you refuse an offer of work or refuse to apply for a job. Now, if I understand the chairman, he's saying that remove the 8-week option for the voluntary quit and leave it available for all other individuals who may suffer disqualification.
Okay. That's what I understand.
The way it is now.
And what do you do with sub 3?
No voluntary quit.
Sub 3, that's what, I don't know. See, that's the part. Maybe with that first sentence, I don't know what you're going to do with it. And this is what Gary asked me earlier. Looking at it, he doesn't know what you're leaving in or what you're taking off. And I can't answer that question. Now, what I want to know is that you're going to have that authority in Section 1, whether in fact you have to take A, B, and C out to be able to come within the definition of due cause. I don't know.
Well, if you take that first sentence,
when you bring in again, did you bring the related fiscal impact with
him? No.
All 17 of
them. Well, that's going to have a great deal of humor. I don't know what I need to
say. It'll be a little difficult to...
Who says 7?
I won't be able to 7:30.
No ball game tonight, but no. Not easy.
I have one other question. I know you're trying to get to a meeting, but online, on, in the bill on page 2, on line 30, how do you administer that or companion clause? Who is a companion? Is that a common law clause?
Not necessarily.
It's a short-term,
I think they got into it. They got into it when, with this, I think in the 72 or 75 session, it got to be, had to do with this affirmative action thing and all the things that had to do with homosexuals and the whole bit. But if you're living with somebody and you're tied together one way or another, so that you are, and we can change the word from spouse to companion in order to get away from that conflict.
Yeah, but you're not answering my question. If two people are living together as homosexuals and they have for 2 weeks, and one of them got, one of them gets transferred and the other one wants to go over, you're going to pay the one.
Not likely if you know what's going on.
The law would disqualify
them. You would.
That's what it says.
But then they can re-qualify if they work for a week.
That's what I'm getting
at. Yeah, that's right.
I think the proper phrase today is probably not companion, the word is friend.
A lot of couples living together today that are not married for whatever reason.
I know that. Forget about the common law, folks. Now, let's take everybody in between that are just companions or friends or whatever you want to use. You disqualify, and then they work a week,
and they're back on.
Not necessarily. There are times when some of these people are also found to have quit without good cause, which gives them a 4-week disqualification. This part of the bill, one doesn't do away with the other.
Well, but put it all in perspective.
Okay, if they left without a good cause, that's a sin. But if they left to go with their companion, that says 1 week.
Yeah, but all right, if they left without good cause to go with their companion, then they've got a 4-week disqualification. They run concurrently, the 1 week and the 4 weeks.
Well, you might determine that it's just because somebody's been living with somebody for a couple of weeks.
I would not make a moral judgment on it, no.
Well, I'm not talking about a moral judgment. You must have some cases like this.
Well, one thing, Representative Wilhelm, this law was also written to take care of the problem of the relatives, such as the aunt taking care, or one sister taking care of another, something like that.
That's a companion.
That's a companion, right. Quite frankly, it hasn't been too controversial. We either don't know about it, or it hasn't been, it hasn't cost us a great deal of trouble.
Well, it could become controversial.
Yes, I believe you're right.
I wonder how Dan Rapper would approach that on 60 Minutes.
Talk to him. Well, now that I think about it, I want two of them on that page 3, question 5. I want the one the way out that I said, but just on the voluntary question, then I want the amendment proposed the way it is right now to disqualify completely under just two, not two and three, but just two. In other words, for the discharge, suspension or something like that, there would be a complete disqualification. I don't want to do it to three, though.
You're still going to leave aviates in there for everybody other than volunteers?
No. That's what I'm saying. As I said, after I thought about it and what your concern was, I'm willing to look at it to two, you know, discharges. In other words, two A, B, C, D, or E. But I do not want to put the automatic disqualification in for sub three, which is this thing about being married or moving or something like that.
Yeah, that's the way we could still be able to
call. Yeah, they would be. Am I correct?
We're talking about the leaving it like it is now for domestic
that situation.
No, we need to disqualify this.
That's right.
Okay.
Thank you. We're in recess.